Okay, so welcome to the ninth conversation at the Anthropology of the Image Lab in UC Davis. The Anthropology of the Image Lab is a space that fosters conversations around questions of the contemporary image, curation of contemporary images, but also conversation between anthropology and philosophy that hope in a quite immodest way to usher new ways of not only thinking about the image, but also beginning to think without images per se. And that's the most difficult task that we will be talking about today. The conversation format of this lab event is very much inspired by a conversation between the philosopher Gilles Deleuze and his former student Claire Parnet. And in the beginning of their book Dialogues, they raise the question, what is a conversation for? And they each have a different understanding of what a conversation is for, but they are very clear that the conversation should not be about reflecting about things, and that the conversation is about the generation of a problem space. And the Anthropology of the Image Lab is very much animated by that search for generating problem space, and I believe, and many of my colleagues and interlocutors believe, that the image is not just the pictorial image, but the image is something that exceeds us. And these conversations are very much curated or organized to think about this excess in the contemporary image. So today I am extremely pleased to and honored to be hosting Alberto Moreras. Alberto Moreras has been a scholar whose work has been important for me in the darkest moments of writing my own work and writing my own book, for reasons that will become apparent today. But I think he's quite a unique voice in contemporary theory and contemporary thinking that enables us to think beyond various questions such as identity, regionalism, and so on. So let me just make a formal introduction. Alberto Moreras is a Spanish-born academic and cultural theorist who currently works at Texas A&M University. Previously, he taught at Duke University and at the Center for Modern Thought at the University of Aberdeen. He's a leading Derridean scholar and theorist of Ibero-American literature, as well as a trenchant critic of the politics of Latin American cultural studies and a trenchant critic of cultural studies to court. His books include Tercer Espacio, The Exhaustion of Difference, a book that has been important for me, Linea de Sombra, and the recently published Maranismo y Inscripción, Maranism and Inscription. He's the co-editor of three journals, namely Journal of Spanish Cultural Studies, Res Publica, and Politica Común. Alberto's work does not lend itself to a singular genre or even discipline, and can be described as stemming from a radically interdisciplinary scholarship. Describing himself as neither identitarian nor a specialist in any one discipline, Moreras likely would scoff at the idea of any systematic or curricular pedagogy of the image, as Gilles Deleuze would say. As a reviewer recently noted, the question of how to create a community of counter-university scholars, both within and beyond the classroom, permeates his work and begs further consideration. Within the context of Latin American literature, a deconstructive pedagogy requires liberating thought from the signifiers such as Latin American literature and Latin American literature, among others. This happens by researching and teaching from otros horizontes y otros parámetros, ya no regionalistas o excepcionalistas, beyond horizons and parameters that are less and less regionalist and exceptionalist. Moreras understands such horizons as beyond any prescribed geopolitical commitments, as well as beyond disciplinary norms and prescriptions, pointing to a theoretical and infra-political elsewhere. And the title of our conversation today is the infra-political image. In this conversation, we will be examining Alberto's concept of infra-politics in relation to the image work of artists he has been engaging recently, including Robert Bresson, the French filmmaker, and painters from Velázquez, Rembrandt, and the American painter Andrew White. So please join me in welcoming Alberto Moreras.
Well, thank you very much, Tarek. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you all for coming. Mm-hmm. And, well, what you need to know is that Tarek sent me a bunch of questions that I read, and reflected upon for a few days, wrote a number of notes. And I think, Tarek, you're not going to reread the questions, right?
I think I'll give you.
Okay, all right. So I will simply give you the theme of the question, and then I'll just, you know, go ahead. And then I will give Tarek an opportunity to follow up on my answers.
And then we'll open it up
and improvise the conversation from there, okay? So Tarek's first question was about the genealogy of the infrapolitical project, okay? He says, you know, where does this stuff, infrapolitics, where does it come from? What is its philosophical provenance? I want to say, first of all, that I am not a professional philosopher, certainly not in their eyes, the eyes of the professional philosophers. So to that extent, I am a bit of an anti-philosopher, perhaps. So I will have to take your genealogical question from there, you know, the genealogical question of the philosophical provenance from an anti-philosophical perspective. And only as far as I am concerned, because, you know, infrapolitics is a collective engagement. The development of infrapolitics is a collective engagement, and I am only speaking in my own name here. So perhaps, first of all, infrapolitics is the register of an insufficiency of common sense, an insatisfaction with conventional, philosophically conventional ways of apprehending the world. And I suppose this is a kind of negative intuition, you know, the insufficiency, the insatisfaction, that has been with me for as long as I can remember, you know, for most of my life. In that sense, infrapolitics is probably not the result of any conscious effort at developing this or that theory or the work of this or that thinker. To a certain extent, it may be the very opposite of that, the attempt to think and to bring up thought as a problem against every existing theory, and certainly against every existing discipline, whether it is Hispanic studies, anthropology, philosophy, literature. You could ask from what perspective then, okay? If I'm denying myself the ground of any discipline, I'm denying myself the ground of philosophy, from what perspective am I speaking? I think from the perspective of the step back, the step back. Infrapolitics is primarily a thinking of the step back, I think. Sure, it is a step back that moves towards no origin, however. It simply moves away from the obvious light to take a better look at the clearing, if we can put it that way. It's a step back, but it is a step back that goes nowhere, okay? It is simply a step back. Robert Bresson, the filmmaker, has had a nice way of putting it once, you know, early in his life. In the 50s, when he made a movie about a famous novel in France at the time, Georges Bernanos' Diary of a Country Priest, Bresson made a movie, and then some journalist interviewed him about it, and he said, well, I was attracted by the figure of the priest in the novel because the priest lives gripped by, and then he says, the impossible nostalgia of an immanence of the world that constantly escapes us. Okay? So I want you to remember that impossible nostalgia for an immanence of the world that escapes constantly, that escapes. A similar feeling probably led me to break away from philosophy into the study of literature many years ago, until that too proved insufficient, okay? Literature is just as insufficient as philosophy to focus on that step back that I'm talking about. Having said that, I don't want to be disingenuous either, you know, I broke my philosophical teeth studying Nietzsche back in Barcelona in the late 70s. And from there was a fairly straight path with some detours, the less particular. To Heidegger and Derrida, Martin Heidegger and Jacques Derrida. I have probably spent more time with their texts than with any other thinker or any other writer. But obviously, I do not want to blame them for infrapolitics, okay? They never used the word, you know? If I said, well, infrapolitics comes from Heidegger and Derrida, they would probably turn around in their graves, and I don't want to disturb them, okay? So, But yes, I think Heidegger and Derrida are the main inspiration for infrapolitics as a path or as an exercise. Exercise is a very interesting word. We can talk about that later in terms of its etymology, exercitium, an exercise of thought and writing. Both of them, Derrida and Heidegger, were thinkers of the step back, okay? Thinkers of the presupposition. Heidegger named the presupposition being. That's a particular metaphorology that he used, okay? Being, the ontological difference. And Derrida may have named it difference, as we know, using another metaphorology, okay? Another constellation of metaphors. And I detect in both of them also that deep nostalgia, unrecognized obviously, disavowed, okay? Nobody wants to be nostalgic, right? Nostalgia is kind of a bad effect. Everybody thinks, oh, nostalgia, what a bore. Mm-hmm. I think we should bring up nostalgia again, even if it is not what it used to be. There is that deep nostalgia for something in facticity beyond facticity, okay? For something in life beyond life. Mm-hmm. Something ungraspable yet all determinate, okay? In my opinion. Mm-hmm. And this is intuitive. I mean, you can think about yourselves, you know, your own feelings of nostalgia about something. What is it that you feel nostalgic about? Is it some specific aspect or something that goes beyond whatever happened and that you can never name? You can never determine. I think infrapolitics also wants to think the presupposition in that sense. We could talk about what precedes or what subsedes politics, political life, the condition of free politics in that sense, in the sense of the condition of every possible politics. Okay. We call it existence. Okay, existence. We can talk about infrapolitical existence. What is that? An existence which is always in every case singular, but never solipsistic, okay? Never limited to yourself, because existence is always a common affair, okay? The infrapolitical register of existence is what I think needs to be thought out. And once you think about it, you realize that we don't have categories for that. We don't have thoughts about that. We don't have words for that. How do we talk about the infrapolitical register of existence? How do we talk about infrapolitical existence? We don't have the vocabulary. We have forgotten the vocabulary, or perhaps it never existed. Infrapolitics confirms in our way, in the way of my own path and my friends, the Heideggerian or the Bressonian or the Derridean obsession with indeterminate existence. Perhaps we could say that infrapolitics is the attempt to put existence, or to put a thought of existence, in deconstruction. Unless that is too silly, but why would it be silly, okay, to put existence in deconstruction? Well, I remember I was in Monaco at a conference many years ago on James Joyce, Phineas Wake. And I was in the restroom and I overheard a couple of guys talking to each other. So what are you doing? Oh, I'm writing my dissertation. What about? Well, I'm doing a deconstruction of Phineas Wake, which of course I thought was a completely silly thing to do, okay? So I think this is even sillier, to deconstruct existence, to put existence in deconstruction, okay? But I think silliness, stupidity, is really part of what infrapolitics is about. So Hegel enables a step back in Heidegger, a movement of displacement, even radical displacement. And perhaps Heidegger enables the deconstructive move in Derrida. So perhaps there are traces in the Derridean text and in the Heideggerian text and in the Hegelian text that would enable me or us to enact a certain radical displacement as well. So I guess one could say, hoping not to be arrogant, or not to be too arrogant, I think there's no arrogance here, okay? But you may disagree. Thinking the unthought of deconstruction is the great and endless task, okay? Thinking the unthought of deconstruction is the great and endless task of infrapolitics. And that would be the infrapolitical rupture, if you want. Also a kind of transfiguration of the image of thought, if you want to put it that way. a transfiguration of the image of thought that we have to think of in epochal terms, in historical terms. Okay, if it is, if there is going to be an infrapolitical rupture, that infrapolitical rupture will mark an epoch of history. Okay, this is where the arrogance thing comes in. Okay. As you know, however, Derrida kept existence at arm's length. He never talked about existence. He never thematized existence. Why is that? Well, I think that Derrida had personal and generational reasons not to talk about existence. Okay, Derrida is essentially a contemporary of Sartre. Derrida is essentially a contemporary of people that were associated with existence philosophy. He didn't want to have anything to do with that, so he moved away from existence and preferred to talk about perhaps life when he did, or more often survey over life, okay, survival. Those personal and generational reasons that Derrida had to keep away from existence are no longer ours. We do not share them. Okay, so I think that existence is a legitimate topic of thought, and I wonder why contemporary thought doesn't want to deal with it. I wonder why existence is such a huge gaping hole in the thematics of contemporary thinking. Okay, why there has been some kind of a taboo regarding thinking existence, and why the substitute formation is obviously politics today. But let me go back for a minute to that something in facticity beyond facticity that I mentioned a moment ago. This semester I have been working with some of my students on the book of Tobit. I don't know if you know it. It doesn't show up in every Bible because it is one of those deuterocanonical books in the Bible, okay? The King James Version that you find in Barnes & Noble doesn't include it, okay? But it is a deuterocanonical book in the Bible, okay? The story in the book of Tobit mentions a young man, Tobiah, the son of a pious man living in exile in Iraq, who nevertheless never forgot to bury the dead, to help out widows and orphans. Tobiah must travel to a remote land for complicated reasons to collect a debt owed his father. And he finds help in a traveling companion, a guy called Raphael, that shows up. Raphael will turn out to be an angel, but of course Tobiah doesn't know about this. Okay? Raphael is an angel, but Tobiah doesn't know. Raphael instructs Tobiah on how to defend himself from a fish that attacks him in the river. He's bathing in the river and a big fish attacks him. Tobiah is scared, and Raphael tells him, "Oh, you know, grab the fish, you know, take out his liver, his bile, his stuff, weird things, weird parts of the animal's body." Okay. How to take advantage of the fish to do some important things in his life? They don't really matter. Perhaps they do. You know, he has to cure his father's blindness with something that he extracts from the fish. Okay. He has to expel a demon from a girl's body, you know, with something he takes from the fist. In other words, Raphael shows Tobiah how to live, okay? How to live effectively, how to live smoothly, okay? How to help himself. Raphael helps Tobiah not to get lost in the desert, for instance, okay? Shows him the way. And then one day, Raphael leaves. Is that the picture that you have there? Yes, the picture is by Rembrandt, okay? The Archangel Raphael leaving the family of Tobiah, you know, leaving, ascending to heaven, okay? Now this is, you can imagine, a completely devastating moment, okay? And Rembrandt became obsessed with it because he painted like 20 different paintings of this, okay? Rembrandt was obsessed with this story, okay? And started painting it obsessively. Many ways, many aspects of the story show up in Rembrandt's paintings. This is the moment in which Raphael leaves, and all the family is left behind, okay? But Tobiah is a young guy, and he will live, the Bible says, to the age of 117 years, okay? By the way, the oldest woman in the world just died, you know, some Italian, and she was 117, so, you know, Tobiah was... And he spends most of his life without the angel. Okay. So the reader is left to wonder whether this life, the unknown life, the life without the angel, the life without words, because the Bible doesn't give us the words for that life, the life that is left is not precisely a life of awaiting. Awaiting for what? Awaiting what? Awaiting the return of the angel. The time that remains for it until death comes. There's a kind of retake of all of this in the famous last scene of Bresson's Pickpocket. Do you have that? Let's take a look at that, but pay very careful attention because this scene is very famous and very important, okay? Because this is a kind of retake of the Book of Tobit.
Something illuminated her face. Illumina sa figure.
Oh Jeanne, pour aller jusqu'à toi, quel drôle de chemin il m'a fallu prendre.
Oh Jeanne, what path did I take to reach you?
The idea is the pickpocket, you know, has been a pickpocket all of his life. He finally gets arrested by the police, thrown into jail, and only then he discovers his love for Jeanne, okay? And says, oh Jeanne, you know, all my life to wait for this moment, and now I discover that I have always been in love with you, and so forth. So I think that this famous last scene, when the main character comes out to the visiting area of the prison and sees Jeanne, and a revelation ensues, and he comments on the fact that all his life had been a kind of impossible waiting for that moment. I wonder whether that is not the case for all of our lives, all of our lives, okay? So I was thinking this semester, perhaps, that life lived in the absence of the angel that can, however, not forget that the angel was with us once, might always return, therefore. An anticipatory life, in spite of all. Is that not an infrapolitical life? Doesn't that life not enclose the secret of infrapolitical existence, the way we want to think about it? I would not know then what kind of genealogy that would imply. We're talking about genealogy. If we want to think about that, what is the philosophical genealogy of it? Perhaps a very ancient one. In any case, it is what came to mind at some point during some difficult years in my professional life, shared with this two people here, Chris and Tim, in part, okay, in Scotland. And those are difficult years that perhaps you have lived too, because in your recent book, The Incurable Image, you constantly mention the need for a break against those images of thought that you connect to the ethnographic turn, that you connect to culture and culturalism, to any number of conventional images that have reified and can no longer sustain thought, can no longer sustain a life of thought, can no longer sustain the thought of a life. Perhaps infrapolitics is the same thing, or part of the same thing. So that's my preliminary answer. So perhaps you have follow-up questions on that, or no, we can move on to the second.
The image of Bresson, last scene in Pickpocket is a quite dreary scene in many regards, because once he has the revelation that he has.
Everyone's having trouble hearing both of you because of the outside noise. So I don't know if you.
I don't think your mic is on.
No, the mic is just to record. It's not.
Yeah, it's gonna sound. Sorry, it's gonna sound better on online. So I will try to speak up.
Yeah, just because of the construction.
So this is a this is not even a question. It's more of a comment that we can mark and then maybe come back to it later. It seems to me that the image of the pickpocket who has developed a set of skills, skills that have been elevated to almost a divine form of revelation, discovers the love, right? Or at least an awareness of this love behind bars, right? So there is something quite perverse in pickpocket in Bresson's setting up that scene. So that's just one. So intrapolitical life is it tragic? Is it what mood would you discern as a way to engage that particular?
Well, Bresson structures the film, okay, as a missed encounter. Okay, the encounter is always already missed. Okay, well, as it would happen in any encounter with the angel. Okay. The angel is what you never find, what you never encounter. It's always around, but you can never grasp him. So that's what happens to our protagonist, the hero, who is a man who is engaged with his hands, you know, has discovered the power of the hands, how easy it is, how difficult it is to seize a wallet or to take a watch from someone. And he's fascinated by this, and he thinks he's a genius at it. So he simply lets his hands work, okay? And spends his life doing that. But of course, this is illegal. He is an outlaw. Okay. I mean, I was just reading a novel on the plane by C.J. Cox, which is called Off the Grid, wonderful thriller. Okay. And it starts with a quotation by, I think it's Cormac McCarthy, that has a lot to do with this, you know. But in any case, the missed encounter organizes the whole narrative, okay? And of course then it becomes tragic. It's always already tragic in the first place. Infrapolitical existence is always already tragic. The thing is, what do we do with it?
So I think one way to connect the first question to the second question through Bresson's pickpocket is the question of vocation. And so the pickpocket, the thief, with skills, with talent, his vocation is precisely to rob things through a kind of divine revelation. I am used to your work dealing with another filmmaker, Raul Ruiz, who is probably the opposite of Bresson in many regards. And we can get back to that later, but it would be interesting to link the question of vocation in Pickpocket, the very act of robbery itself, which is quite present in Deleuze's philosophy of difference, to the question of politics as vocation in Max Weber, and then the question of vocation in Hannah Arendt. And I think there is a bridge here that can be used, since my next question was, how would you link infrapolitics to the two canonical texts that we've read in this class, Politics, Science, and Vocation in Weber, and Truth and Politics by Hannah Arendt.
Yeah, okay. In order to get to that, and by the way, the quotation I was talking about before was, you have to be really honest to be an outlaw, okay? You have to be really honest to be an outlaw, you know? That's what is at stake in the protagonist here, okay? That was, of course, not the case for Hannah Arendt or Max Weber, okay? And that's my critique of them. But I think that before we get to Weber and Arendt, I think I'd like to speak about the image of thought.
Please, yes.
In order to clarify to keep clarifying the context, because you know we're moving towards something like a proto theory of the infrapolitical image. Okay, so I'm building up my narrative for that.
Just speak.
Yeah, sorry. So the second question that Tariq sent me by email was on the image of thought. Okay, he said, well, you know, you really, you know, is there an image of thought for you? Okay, or what is your relationship to the notion of the image of thought? And then, of course, I thought that the notion of image is very complicated, you know, and I wonder whether there can be an image of the image. You know, I think an image of thought, do I have an image of the image of thought? You see, can there be an image of the image? And the question is disconcerting, okay? How do we answer that? Is there an image of the image? I think that is what makes it very clear that we are in the presence of a real problem, okay? You were talking about the generation of a problem space, okay? This might be the beginning of it. Is there an image of the image? Well, you know, one of the definitions of image is mental conception common to many, okay? Common sense, okay? Based on some received ideology or language idiom, okay, these images varied from English to French to Swahili and so forth. Mm-hmm. I think we could say that there are still images and images, okay? Because some of them are ideological images, some of them are not quite ideological images, but something else. But we would have to develop a full phenomenology of the image. But take the pictorial image, mm-hmm. which is something that we can all identify. Mm-hmm. I am very interested in images that break through into their frame. Okay, frame in English is in Greek is parergon, mm-hmm. from para, which means around. Ergon means the work. Okay, so what is around the work? Mm-hmm. So I am very interested in parergonal images, or images that break through to their frame, mm-hmm. to their parergon. Mm-hmm. Images that exceed themselves. In other words, okay. Since we were talking about the Book of Tobit, consider the series of etchings and oils that Rembrandt did on that story, usually having to do with the angel abandoning Tobiah, or the angel walking along with him, or the angel giving him advice and instructions. And there are other paintings about other parts of the story. So there is an obsessive quality to those images, okay, which is probably deeply singular to Rembrandt himself. Okay. Those images respond, they're a constellation that refer to an obsession, okay? And that obsession was a singular obsession of the painter himself. Mm-hmm. Through which the image kind of breaks out of itself into something else, which is, however, not yet the allegorical or the metaphorical image, okay? In other words, you say, well, what are these images about? And there is no answer to that, okay? These are not allegorical images. Mm-hmm. The angel leaves the family. So what? Mm-hmm. Is it about God? No, it isn't. Okay. What is it about? There is no answer to that. There is no allegory. There is no metaphor here. Okay. And that is quite.
Literal.
Yeah. Sorry about that. You know. Images that have no metaphoric plane, images that have no allegorical reference, okay? Mm-hmm. Images that exceed themselves into something that we cannot name. Mm-hmm. We could say the image spills into the uncontained or indeterminate. Mm-hmm. And those images tend to produce thought, okay? They make us think. Mm-hmm. Tend to have a genetic effect in the viewer, mm-hmm. as it no doubt was the case for the painter, for Rembrandt, for instance. Mm-hmm. And they can be wrenching too, okay? They can be wrenching, they can be painful, okay? Allow yourself to become obsessed for a minute with this image of the angel leaving, mm-hmm. okay? And see how painful that can be, even for you, mm-hmm. okay? I think of those images as what I call demetaphorized images, okay? Demetaphorized. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that they are simply literal images. They are something other than literal images. The images do not end in themselves, do not end in the materiality of their own matter, okay? But when Tarek asks about the image of thought, I know he's referring to the work of a fellow called Gilles Deleuze that some of you may be familiar with. Mm-hmm. Because Deleuze wrote an important book in the 60s called Difference and Repetition, mm-hmm. and there is a famous third chapter in which Deleuze talks about the image of thought. Mm-hmm. And it figures prominently in Tarek's latest book, mm-hmm. The Incurable Image. Mm-hmm. So you talk about the incurable image, which is a very nice formulation, I think. Incurable, playing with curate and cure, okay? It is an image resistant to curation, probably because it is an image that has exceeded itself, has abandoned common sense, and is now in some wild territory of thought, okay? Where does an image go that exceeds common sense, okay? Where does it go? Mm-hmm. It goes into some wild territory of thought for which we have no name. Mm-hmm. I used to call such images in a previous work that I did savage hybrid, okay? Savage hybrid images. I am sorry about the huge noise. It's worrying me. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I would say that Tarek's incurable image is at its best generative, okay? It produces thoughts, okay? But only after having a deeply anergonic effect. I'm playing with ergon, the root, the Greek root for work, okay? Anergonic, without work, deworking or unworking, okay? An effect of destructive unworking, which is of course both critical and liberating, okay? But potentially also catastrophic, and we never know in advance. You start playing with your own passion, okay? Looking at the departure of the angel, and you never know what is going to happen to you, okay? It can be critical in terms of your own life, in terms of your own existence. It can be liberating in terms of your own existence. It can give you new thoughts, fresh thoughts, but those thoughts are not necessarily joyful and happy thoughts. You never know what's going to happen, okay? They could have a catastrophic effect on you. And the incurable image that Tarek talks about, the incurable image is a potentially always a catastrophic image. You cannot play around with those things without getting burnt. Okay? If I remember correctly, Deleuze says that such images are proper to what he calls the underground man, the underground man, which is a figure he takes out of Fyodor Dostoevsky's work, okay? The underground man. A radical stranger, or rather an intruder, okay? Another figure that you use, the intruder, okay? I don't know, I come from Texas, so I recently watched a movie called Hell or High Water. Have you seen it? Have you seen Hell or High Water? Well, in that movie you have, there's a moment in which one of the brothers goes to a casino, okay? And meets a Comanche guy there at the bar. And he asks something of the Comanche, and the Comanche says, "Look, my friend, a Comanche only has enemies." Okay? An underground man, the Comanche. This underground man is the infrapolitical man. Okay? Or woman. Okay? So that's what we're talking about. The images produced by the underground man or woman. The man or the woman that only has enemies. Pascal Quignard, a very important French writer, I don't know if you know him, he is not so well known in the United States, wrote a book called Brief Treatises, Petit Traité. He elaborates at the beginning of the first volume on why language, the logos in general, must be treated always and in every case as a deep deceiver. The alienator par excellence, okay? We are thinking about language, and we normally think about language as our friend. Well, what if we thought about language as our enemy? Images are, in that sense, deep deceivers as well, okay? They lie with the truth, or with a certain truth. I think Deleuze talks about these things as terrible revelations, the terrible revelations of the underground man or woman. The terrible revelations that force the underground man into destructive critique, just to clear the ground, without ever knowing whether he's proceeding from stupidity or madness, from something savaging him at any rate, meant to generate an improbable thought without image. Deleuze says a thought free of all empirical elements and yet at the same time totally empirical as well. This thought without image is the very opposite of the image of thought, okay? So, image of thought, thought without image. Understanding the image of thought as the dogmatic or moral image of thought, which in my opinion is the Deleuzian version of what Heidegger or Derrida would have called the metaphysical image of thought. So Deleuze calls for a thought without image that would overturn the image of thought that comes to us from the tradition and would inaugurate a new politics, Deleuze says. I suppose this is what he meant in the later work that he wrote, famous book, What is Philosophy, with Félix Guattari, under the name of Geophilosophy. You know, they talk about geophilosophy in a very important fifth chapter, I believe. But this geophilosophy understood as a new politics of the earth, a new politics of the earth without image. Is it not better thought of as infrapolitics? That's my claim, of course. I prefer to think about that geophilosophy as infrapolitics. I used the word transfiguration earlier. I meant to use it in a rather specific sense. For me, transfiguration, in this context we're now using, and remember I have been speaking about demetaphorized images, okay? So try to think at the same time transfiguration and demetaphorization. The context of the passage from the image of thought to a thought without image. Transfiguration in that context has to do with the paragonic valence of the image, the shifting potential of the image into another figure, to something that is never the figural plane, however. The transfiguration does not leap into another figure, rather traverses the figure and makes it exceed itself. Okay, that's the key thing. Okay, it is a transfiguration that doesn't lead to another figure, simply traverses the figure and makes it exceed itself. Think about that angel leaving. This is the Bressonian composition. Sorry, I have been working on Bresson this semester with my students, so I am obsessed with Bresson these days. In one of the, he wrote a little book, 50 pages. He worked on it for his whole life, okay? It's called Notes from a Cinematograph, okay? It's just 50 pages, his only book. He never wrote anything but that. But he worked on it for 40 years, okay? And he says there something like, our language of images, our writing, our cinematography, our audiovisual writing in general must abandon the image. The images must ruin the idea of image. That's what he wants to accomplish with his films, okay? Images that ruin the idea of image. Images that are only relations, paragonic bonds with things and beings, he says at some point, okay? Images are only bonds with between things and beings and nothing but. If an image is reified into image, it's ruined, okay? Then it's a theatrical image, he says. I think all of Bresson's films are an extraordinary example of demetaphorized image. If you want, transfigure images under erasure. Images that seek to dwell in the radical immanence of the empirical that always escapes, okay? Of the experience that we cannot determine, of the experience that we cannot name. Of that nostalgia that we do not, that has no object for us. This production of relations against the image of thought, it may be madness or stupidity. Remember, you know, it could be catastrophic. How do we know? But it is also infrapolitics, whether it is stupidity, madness, or indeed radical intelligence, it is still infrapolitics, since it always points to whatever precedes politics as its condition, okay? I don't know if you've been to Chicago, to the Art Institute, you know, wonderful museum. I was lost there once and I wanted to go to the, again, to the restroom. I'm sorry, it's the second time I mentioned the restroom. And I ran into a painting by Velázquez, okay? Which is in a small corridor, out of the way, okay? This portrait, okay, of a kitchen maid, okay, finishing up cleaning the kitchen, apparently, right? Look at the kitchen utensils, the cups, the silver or the tin pots, the jugs. I claim that these are already thought beyond the image, okay? Velázquez puts them in a relational universe that includes the world as such, okay? Look at the absorption of the kitchen maid, okay? As he goes about her work. It is a world that does not point beyond itself, okay? There is no allegory here. Is there an allegory here? No. This is no metaphor of anything. It doesn't send you to any different world, okay? It points to itself. It points to itself, and yet that is what makes it poignant and even painful, if you want. I think Velázquez also painted several versions of this. Okay, there are kitchen maid oils or mulata oils in several places, not just at the Art Institute of Chicago, in other places. Obsession or something else. These are images that shatter the image of thought in the Deleuzean sense, because they won't let themselves be tamed by any common sense or dogmatic conception. they are savage hybrid images, if you want, or incurable images, as Tarek theorizes in his book. Okay, incurable images. How do you tame this in a museum? Okay, you have to put it out of the way. Okay, I mean, it is an absolutely glorious painting. You have to go and see it. Okay, you'll see what I mean. Mm-hmm. The reproduction doesn't quite honors the image as you can see it. Okay. And this reminds me of something I also wanted to mention, and this is the end of my answer to the second question. In spite of the fact that Deleuze beats on Heidegger in the very first page of that chapter 3 of Difference and Repetition, I think that text on the image of thought is a repetition of Heidegger's famous 1938 text on the age of the world picture. The world picture, that is the world image. The German word is Bild, which can be translated into both image or picture. Heidegger's main point throughout is that there is no notion of world image that is not intrinsically associated to the modern conception of the subject, of subjectivity. In other words, the image of thought is already a subjective appropriation of the world. Okay. That text includes a radical critique of anthropology, by the way. And I know that your own notion of anthropology tries to undo subjectivism, along with any culturalism and any anthropocentrism. Okay. You see, if you look at this from the point of view of the subject, you destroy the painting. Okay. You really do. We can talk about that as much as you want. Okay. Let's say if you have a fetishistic relationship to the kitchen maid here, you're destroying the painting. Okay. That's just an example, by the way, of a subjectivist appropriation of the painting. In that text, Heidegger talks about subjectivism as, I quote, the shadow of a passing cloud over a hidden land. The shadow of a passing cloud over a hidden land. Meaning that the land is hidden, concealed, and the image of thought is itself the concealment, and the subjectivity of the subject hides on its other side, as it were, the potential clearing of the shadow. This would be the transfiguration, the clearing of the shadow. We are far from it. We are far from it. We don't even have a language for it. But infrapolitics is a word pointing in that direction. Okay. So this is my take on the notion of the image of thought, or indeed thought without an image. And I wonder whether you have any follow-up questions on that.
I have a question, but for the sake of time, I think we should proceed with
your, Weber and Arendt.
Yeah. Okay. And the question has already been
asked. Okay. So I have great respect for Weber and Arendt as political thinkers. I do not recall any specific reference in Weber's essay, Politics as a Vocation, to the allegory of the cave. I think the reference you told me comes in Science as a Vocation, which is a companion essay, but not quite the same. Probably not quite as important either. But it certainly is very present in Arendt's essay. In her case, it connects to the philosopher who returns to the people to tell them the ineffable truth resulting from his difficult contemplation of the sun. You remember the allegory of the cave, right? The philosopher goes out, looks at the sun, comes back in. Arendt says that the people will probably kill this fellow, the philosopher who goes back in, as his truth could damage all too many powerful interests. Or perhaps just one interest, the interest of a crude interest, in fact, the interest of facticity, okay? A guy who returns and tells them, you're all full of shit, okay? It's unacceptable, okay? So perhaps Plato's philosopher stands in Arendt's text for what Weber calls the ethics of ultimate ends, okay? The uncompromising commitment to truth, to factual truth in the first place, which in Weber figures as an ethics of principle, okay? And politics, of course, would be something else. At best, a negotiation with truth, and at worst, completely heterogeneous with it, okay? What is the relationship between ethics and politics? This is what is going on here, okay? And Weber and Arendt have similar, but ultimately perhaps contrary takes. At a certain point in her text, Arendt recognizes that truth, in the strong sense of philosophical truth or theoretical truth, and politics are indeed heterogeneous. The passage between the two realms is called metabasis. He uses this Greek term, metabasis, passage, but let's say passage to transit to a change thing, okay? Change in a sense, okay? Metabasis, which is a word from Plato. Arendt says metabasis is the passage from one way of human existence to another, okay? From ethics to politics, or from politics to ethics, okay? Infrapolitics is also a metabasis in respect of politics. It invokes another region of existence, and it is from there that we may perhaps critique Arendt's and Weber's assumptions, even in their own terms. In other words, infrapolitics is not anti-political. Infrapolitics can discuss politics, can still discuss politics, but infrapolitics is critical of politics, okay? For instance, what is the great assumption in the Weberian essay? What is Weber's image of thought there? His ethics of responsibility point to the presence of the great hero, okay? The demagogue, the politician by vocation. This is very important, for instance, for Spain, for Spanish politics at this point, okay? Because of Podemos, okay? The leader, okay? The thought of the leader. We need a political leader. We need Pablo Iglesias, or we need Íñigo Rejón, or we need Marine Le Pen, or we need Trump. Because without the great leader, there is no politics, okay? Everything falls in the facticity of the establishment of the system and so forth. Is that true? Okay. For Weber, he says, the great politician, the demagogue, in a positive sense, the leader, is somebody who always already says, like Luther, here I stand, I can do no other. Okay? Famous words. Here I stand, I can do no other. Okay? Luther is invoking politics, okay, and is invoking the limits of politics, and yet he says, here I stand, I can do no other. Okay? This is the path. Okay? And screw the consequences. Ethics of responsibility for Weber. The responsibility of politics, the dignity of politics, which in Weber always falls on the side, on the shoulders of the great leader. The leader wants power. That is clear for Weber. Wants tendentially a monopoly on power. Wants a monopoly on violence, wants a monopoly on political force, wants a monopoly on the state, wants total control of the state. The political leader is always about total control of the state, certainly Weber. Even if not for the sake of domination, rather for the sake of political accomplishment. But in any case, Weber is very clear, the politician seeks domination, wants domination. Political accomplishment requires domination. I do not dispute that. What I would dispute, however, is the exclusive adjudication of political charisma to the heroic leader. Okay? In my opinion, that is an image of thought that comes from the tradition. From the tradition. From metaphysics. Okay? From the common sense image of thought. Take a look at Hegel's wonderful pages in the philosophy of history on the world historical hero, okay? In a sense, Weber is rewriting those pages, okay? He's rewriting Hegel. The hero is for Weber the roots of history, the roots of reason in history. Even if Weber has given up on the notion of absolute spirit, of a notion of an end of history, and talks rather a polar night. He talks about a polar night of icy storms and so forth. But even here, the implication is that only the political hero could prevent that polar night from materializing, okay? And this charismatization, this heroification of the political leader, I think, is something that we no longer need. Weber understands even clearly, you know, that there is a choice, a political choice, between what he calls a leaderless democracy and a leadership democracy, and he opts for the second, okay? He says, no leaderless democracy, give me leadership democracy anytime. He thinks a leaderless democracy is something like the purveyor of a domination without image. And only the leader can provide the image, which of course always already is the image of the people, the image of the nation. Okay? The assumption is that the image is liberating, but this is an empty assumption. Think about Trump. Let's make America great again. Okay. Your book, Tarek, takes issue with the Mexican condition, linking it to those troubles of modernity, post-revolutionary Mexico and so forth, okay, nationalism, okay, the image of thought of post-revolutionary Mexico, the cosmic rays and all of that stuff. You want to break away from all of that, probably in the wake of a similar intuition, I think. Weber is still caught up in modern subjectivity, in modern premises concerning political subjectivity, from which derives a conception of power that we may have to re-examine. Of course, I would propose against Weber the political pursuit today of a leaderless democracy, where charisma could be on the side of things, of institutions and procedures, in the name of no apotheosic image of thought, which always implies a philosophy of history. Okay? This is crucially important because I think populism is the politics of the future. Okay? But if populism is still a populism of the leader, I think we're screwed. Okay? We're doomed. Okay? We need to come up with a notion of an anarcho-populism. Okay? Of a populism without leaders. Arendt is probably more persuasive than Weber in her love of radical democracy and her rejection of domination, and would probably have been readier to endorse the notion of a leaderless democracy. But her defense of philosophical truth and its particular form of coercion still privileges the hero as agent. Remember when she elaborates on the notion that the Socratic principle, it is better to suffer injustice than to do injustice. It is better to suffer wrong than to do wrong. She says that's the only political principle philosophy has ever contributed. She says that, and she's very emphatic on the only political principle that philosophy has provided. Okay? It is better to suffer wrong than to do wrong. It does not matter that the philosophical principle is impolitical. It is impolitical, as Arendt says. But there is a certain coercion or domination of the principle in political life, at least potential. In other words, Arendt seems to be claiming an ethics of principles in politics as well from the philosophical metabasis. Her reasoning is a man divided against himself is a contradiction in terms. You know, you cannot function. If you do wrong, you are working against yourself. And that makes you a broken person. Okay? So a nation that does wrong is also a broken nation. Okay? So this is the philosophical contribution to political life, which is, however, a principal contribution and therefore subjects politics to philosophy, you see? And of course the hero here is not the politician, as it was in Weber, but the philosopher, Socrates, or Arendt herself. How can we guarantee the influence of philosophical truth on politics, the Socratic principle? In order to guarantee an acceptable kind of domination, okay? You want to be dominated, well, be dominated by a philosophical principle. Arendt says that it can only be a matter of example, okay? And these examples are presented as intuitions that mark the imagination. Socrates' death is the great example here. Jesus' death, okay? The Socratic metabasis happens through the example of his exemplary death, which is the way in which philosophical truth comes to have political import. Che Guevara's death. So it is the exemplariness of a philosophical life that should, if it only could, rule democracy. Obviously, this is not a defense of the decisive and deciding leadership of the demagogue in democracy. It is something else, perhaps even close to the notion of a leaderless democracy, since the example as such has no coercive power. But it is still a thought of the political hero, okay, through the philosopher in this case. So I think the limit to Arendt is precisely that, similar to the limit in Weber. For her, politics is the place of freedom, the region of action, where an individual can exercise his or her freedom, and that is all right, it is serious enough. My point would be that as an existential choice, and the same goes for Weber in a different way, Arendt's politics are infrapolitical, a certain kind of infrapolitical exercise. In other words, one does politics as a vocation or as a commitment to singular freedom on behalf of oneself or on behalf of others, or both, for the sake of something in politics which escapes politics. That is the infrapolitical horizon. No politics is good enough whose outcome does not enact a radical expansion of the infrapolitical space. No politics is good enough for the sake of politics. Politics is not an end, therefore, which is also why one cannot have infrapolitics without politics. It is simply a change of emphasis. Okay, but this is not explicitly recognized in Arendt. Okay, so that's my critique. Let me put it this way: democratic politics aims at the liberation of a non-hegemonized space, a free space, which is infrapolitical space. We can also call it post-hegemonic space. Weber or Arendt never glimpsed that. There is a blindness to infrapolitics, which is, in my opinion, thoroughly connected to the radical domination of modern subjectivity in thought. Another way of putting it is that all politics want to be heliopolitics. Helio is the word for the sun, okay? Politics of the sun. Politics of the light of the subject. Politics of the apotheosis of the subject as light. The political subject wants to become political substance. This is Hegel. Politics is always dialectic. There is a dialectical image of politics that happens to be almost all pervasive today. Paradoxically, perhaps, the sun blinds, okay? The sun still blinds us. We are all in the position of the philosopher in Plato's allegory of the cave, okay? But we are equally deluded by the sun, as we were by the shadow. Against that, of course, infrapolitical or post-hegemonic populism proposes a different thing, a transformational thinking that does not look at the light and does not find its impetus in or from the light. Rather, it finds it in the dark, from the dark of existence as a possibility of freedom. Infrapolitics is really a countergaze to dialectics and to dialectical politics. It is also a countergaze in the sense that it does not function through the contemplation of the image of thought, which is always the copy of heliopolitical domination. The move to the countergaze, the move to the countergaze is the metabasis that infrapolitics proposes. Okay, so please remember the notion of countergaze. Okay, away from heliopolitics. Okay, I know it is difficult. We have to be patient with this stuff.
I think also because of the sake of time, you should proceed.
With the next. Okay, well, the quick. All right, yeah, I only have a couple of pages to go. The fourth question that Tarek asked me was on fireflies, okay? Fireflies. Why? Because there is an important book by a French art historian called Georges Didi Huberman. I don't know if you are familiar with him, which is called something like The Survival of the Fireflies. And so I wanted to say that, yes, what I just called the countergaze to a dialectics of the subject does not simply shun the light in favor of the shadow. It is not only or just a matter of moving from a heliopolitics to what we could call a skiopolitics. Okay? There's a famous Greek saying, Pindar, okay? Skias on aranthropos. Man is the dream of a shadow, which Jorge Luis Borges famously mistranslates as man is the shadow of a dream, okay? The dark has its own light. The night has its own light. I don't know if you remember, you're too young, all of you are too young to remember Patti Smith's 1988 song, Because the Night, okay? It was a song that was actually composed by Bruce Springsteen, okay? One of the verses is, we believe in the night we trust. Okay, we believe in the night we trust. That's why I like so much the notion of the survival of the fireflies in Didi Huberman. He's talking about Pasolini, of course, the famous text from 1975, in which Pasolini gives up on the enchantment with the fireflies. This is terrible because this is one of the last texts Pasolini writes. He's murdered right after that, okay? He says, I no longer believe in the fireflies. And then he's killed, okay? Mysteriously, okay? The fireflies were originally mentioned by Pasolini in an early text, talking about his experience as a child, okay? In southern Italy, and he talked about the enchantment of the fireflies. But in Pasolini's text, the enchantment of the fireflies is also an enchantment with bodies. Okay, with bodies in the night. Okay, of course this is deeply sexualized thinking. Okay, the fireflies in Pasolini's text are an image of the glimmer of the night of love. Okay, the fireflies are bodies in the night. By 1975, Pasolini gives up on that, and then he gets killed. Mm-hmm. And then Giorgio Agamben takes up all of this, mm-hmm. and remembers the fireflies of his own childhood. By the way, I just saw some fireflies in Texas the other night. Mm-hmm. And Giorgio Agamben says in The Kingdom of the Glory, one of his famous books, mm-hmm, that the fireflies have all been burned today, mm-hmm, in the light, the blinding light of the society of the spectacle, okay? Mm-hmm. Which he links to the high beings of fascist police cars in Pasolini's text, okay? He says, well, you know, Pasolini talked about the police cars, the fascist police cars that came and you know, with blinding light, you know, kept the children from playing in the night, okay? And Giorgio Agamben says, well, the society of the spectacle is doing that to us every day today, okay? There are no longer fireflies. Mm-hmm. The fireflies maybe stand for images of the night, but if so, they are a special kind of image, an image that does not copy, does not represent, an image of pure desire, an image of pure awaiting, okay? The images of the night are already thought without an image. What is your own relationship to the fireflies? Have you ever seen fireflies? Hmm? Are they an allegory of anything? Hmm? Are they a metaphor for something? The notion of survival becomes important here because Didi Huberman wants to deny the possibility of a total destruction of experience. Didi Huberman wants to deny the possibility of a total destruction of the fireflies against Pasolini and against Agamben, okay? He says, of course the fireflies haven't been destroyed. Nobody can burn all the fireflies. Hmm? But then Didi Huberman commits a failure of imagination, okay? And Heath says that if the fireflies are today the locus of the impossibility of apocalypse, okay? The witness of a remainder, okay? The reminder that something always remains, the angel always remains, okay? Didi Huberman says, and that's politics. And no, for God's sake, that's a failure of imagination. Mm? The fireflies do not really point to the perpetual survival of the political as much as they point to infrapolitics. Mm-hmm. Infrapolitics is that indestructible remainder that in fact politics cannot but cover over, okay? Politics will cover it over every time. Mm-hmm. So one should not argue that the way for the return of the angel is political in nature. This is what Didi Huberman would do. Mm-hmm. The wait is not a wait for redemption. It is an action without action that has its own import. Fireflies of the night are the markers of an attentive wait at the very vanishing point of politics, okay? They are not a standing for politics, okay? They are not a metaphor for politics. You can wait for politics or you can wait politically if you want, if you choose, but politics does not exhaust the awaiting. Politics are in every case a compensatory formation for the awaiting. Those images of the night are not subordinate to political redemption. This is my point. I think it's a simple point, and yet everything hinges on it, okay? The images of the night are not subordinate to political redemption. Infrapolitical existence does not wait for political redemption. If they were, we would indeed be doomed, okay? There could be no survival if that were the case. Hmm. Well, Bresson said to cinematography that it was the art of representing nothing, okay? I think that we need to think about the images of the night as also images that represent nothing. Mm-hmm. We're coming to the end. Let me try to sum it all up, trying to say something else in references to two images that I think are important. One of them is Andrew Wyeth's famous Wind from the Sea, okay? Okay, there it is. Mm-hmm. Andrew Wyeth was a funny guy. He said that he wanted to paint his life. All he wanted to do was to paint his life, okay? And this is part of that. He's painting his life. Mm-hmm. Part of his life happened in Cushing, Maine, mm-hmm, and it is from there that we have this work, okay? From Maine, okay? You see a window, a curtain, a landscape, and of course, there's a book now with all the preliminary work, a big book, fascinating book, okay? All the studies, all the drawings, all the pre-paintings and so forth. Guaid paints his life. He also said he painted his emotions in another interview. Mm-hmm. But actually what he's painting is invisible. You notice that's the funny thing about this painting. What he's painting in this painting is the invisible, okay? So how can you paint the invisible? Mm-hmm. He's painting the wind, okay? He's painting what cannot be seen. Mm-hmm. The image can only refer to it. The image cannot paint the wind. The wind is only a trace in the image. But that trace is precisely what matters here, okay? Mm-hmm. That trace is the figure of infrapolitics, okay? If you want, that trace is infrapolitics transfigured, okay? And we could say the same thing about another set of images, Paul Cézanne's paintings of Montaigne Saint-Victoire, okay? He was obsessed with this. Mm-hmm. See if we can find it, okay? He painted this landscape 200 times, okay? He would go every morning and stand in front of the mountain and paint it over and over and over again. For years he did nothing but this, okay? We're seeing some examples of it, right? Mm-hmm. And Heidegger was particularly taken with this stuff, okay? Why? Why would you paint the same mountain, not once, not twice, but hundreds of times? Why? Why would you do that? What are you after when you do something like that? Mm-hmm. In a note written towards the end of his life, just a year or two before his death, Heidegger wrote that Cézanne is also painting the invisible, like Andrew Wyeth, okay? Or as he put it, this is a complicated sentence, but he says, Cézanne is painting the appearing of presencing in the clearing of presence. I repeat, the appearing of presencing in the clearing of presence. That is, the very possibility of the image, of any image, the precondition or the presupposition of the image, not just of an image of thought, but of thought as image as well. Heidegger says something important in that little note. He refers to Cézanne's work as a naming of the outstanding, okay? He says, well, Cézanne is trying to name the outstanding. Mm-hmm. What outstands, the image that exceeds or precedes itself and floods the frame, floods the parergon, floods the frame, composes relations that cannot be captured through any dogmatic image of thought. I think an infrapolitical image is always, in every case, the naming of the outstanding, if we can get to it. Mm-hmm. For the most part, however, what we can call second order infrapolitics, I haven't talked about that, but we can talk about that later. In other words, the conscious reflection on infrapolitics, you know, infrapolitics is also facticity and it is everywhere, but the conscious reflection on it, if you want transfigure infrapolitics, can only prepare for the outstanding, cannot see it, can only prepare for it. Thank you very much. Those are my questions to Tarek's, my answers to Tarek's questions.
So now what I would like to suggest, since we are getting short on time, but I think it's great that you were able to read your answers and give us a sense of what you are currently working on. I certainly have more questions that, you know, I would like to add, but I'd like to give an opportunity to some of our friends here and students to engage your response to my questions. But I would like just to just perhaps give you two prompts, and maybe if you can answer them. The first one is a question that I've already asked you. How do you go from Raul Ruiz, whom Chris also has written about, and you know, a filmmaker that has been very important to many of us, how do you move from Raul Ruiz to Bresson? And to me, it's a beautiful leap. I like the idea, and I think it would be interesting to see how you engage that contrast, if contrast there is. And then the second point is the status of the image as something that we are often engaging through a hermeneutics of suspicion. And the reason why I invited you to think about Weber was not necessarily to talk about Weber, the social scientist. It's more about the status of the allegory of the cave within both Arendt's text and Weber's text. Mm-hmm. And then later on it reappears in Agamben in the image of the society of spectacle. And many of us have been very skeptical about their skepticism towards the so-called society of spectacle, or there is a sense of uneasiness that the image is lies, that there is something there that cannot be trusted, right? So that's, we've already talked about this, but I wanted to kind of insist on the fact that the engagement with Weber and Arendt had to do with, are you bringing a hermeneutics of suspicion into your engagement with images or not?
And yeah. Well, I'm bringing.
Then we can open.
Yeah, I'm bringing a hermeneutics of suspicion to bear on the heliopolitical image, which I believe is the dominating image in Arendt and Weber, in spite of everything. Okay, these two thinkers are heliopolitical thinkers. Mm-hmm. Again, helio refers to the sun. Okay. And of course, they are therefore Platonists, even if they want to deny it. Okay, because even though Plato's interpretation of the allegory of the cave is a very complicated one, and even though Plato himself transcended his own interpretation of the allegory of the cave by referring to this to the mysterious epikeina tes ousias, the beyond substance. Okay, the sun beyond the sun. Okay, he says. It is not the sun that should worry us. It is whatever is beyond the sun. But my claim is that what is beyond the sun is just another sun. Okay? And I want to move away from all of that. And infrapolitics, let's say as a hermeneutics of suspicion, rejects all heliopolitical claims, including the Weberian and the Arendtian one.
So we're not. So you're not returning to the cave to give lessons to.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. That's why I am very comfortable with the notion of the images of the night. Okay, and where I claim that the night has its own light. Okay, so for me this is a, because it is an anti-allegorical thinking. Okay, it can never adapt the allegory of the cave as founding. Okay, in other words, I think that the very notion of the image of thought is as your question already implies. Okay, the fact that you are asking that question. The notion of the image of thought is thoroughly connected with allegorical thought, metaphorical thought, and so forth, you know? Thought that establishes a literal plane and a figural plane of reference, okay? Infrapolitics is the very opposite of that, precisely because it wants to focus on immanence, okay? Radical immanence that always escapes, okay? In terms of Raoul Ruiz, that's a more complicated question, paradoxically. Why is it complicated? Because it is mysterious to me. I don't know what happened, okay?
Just a few things about Raoul Ruiz.
Yeah, well, Raoul Ruiz is a friend of ours. You know, he was our companion in Aberdeen. You know, Tim was there as a visitor many times. Chris and I were colleagues at the University of Aberdeen. We invited Raoul to join us as a colleague, and he was a great man. He died a few years ago, unfortunately, of a bad cancer of the liver, and he's a great filmmaker from Chile who worked in France most of his life. Made 130 or 140 films. And because I had many conversations with Raoul, I always thought that his film making was also infrapolitical in nature. Okay? I probably think it still is. I just don't know. I have lost my way of interpreting Raoul Ruiz's film making at this point. Okay? I taught this semester a class which I thought was going to be about Raoul Ruiz, and it turned into a class about Bresson. What can you do? You know, the name of the class was The Infrapolitical Image, An Introduction to the Cinema of Raoul Ruiz, and all of a sudden we started looking. I had initially set up, you know, Jean-Pierre Melville and Robert Bresson as two important filmmakers in France when Raoul arrives in France in 1973, you know, in order to establish a comparison between Melville's filmmaking, Bresson's filmmaking, and Raoul Ruiz's filmmaking. But I thought the hero of the class was going to be Raoul Ruiz, and just hasn't been the case. Okay, and why is that? Probably my fault. Okay, I have lost my way of relating to Raoul Ruiz's images, precisely because I was so impressed with Bresson, and Raoul Ruiz is the very opposite of Bresson. Okay, Bresson's films are films of simplicity, against theater, against acting. Okay, against what he calls the theatrical image. And I think that, you know, Raoul's films are probably films about the theatrical image, mostly and radically so. So I have lost my way of theorizing Raúl Ruiz. So that's my limitation. I mean, he was a great friend. I don't want to criticize him. But that's what happened. Mm-hmm.
I think we should take some questions.
What do you mean by the fireflies allegory metaphor? What was the metaphor for the firefly?
Firefly.
Yes.
You're asking me to connect firefly, allegory, and metaphor, right? Well, again, you know, we're talking about a sequence of texts about fireflies that are Pasolini, Agamben, and then Didi Uberman, right? Mm-hmm. For Pasolini, the fireflies are an image for bodies in the night, in other words, for sex, okay? For indiscriminate sex at an early age, you know, for adolescent sex, if you want, okay? That's the function they have, the fireflies, in Pasolini's text. Mm-hmm. For Agamben, the fireflies are an image, a metaphor, an allegory, if you want. Mm-hmm. I mean, we'll have to see what the difference between metaphor and allegory is in the context of those particular texts, but I don't think we should go into that now. It would be too lengthy. For Agamben, the fireflies are an image of pleasure, an image of goodness, an image of joy, of joyful life, which he claims has been destroyed by the society of the spectacle, by the blinding lights of the society of the spectacle. Okay. My take is that the fireflies are images that are neither metaphorical nor allegorical because they refer to nothing outside themselves. Mm-hmm. They are images of the night. Okay. And they are as images similar to the images that we have been seeing. The Montaigne's and Victoire in Cézanne's paintings, the angel in Rembrandt, the wind in Wyeth, okay? Images that exceed themselves, images that remind us of something in facticity, beyond facticity, that we cannot name, that we cannot identify, that we cannot appropriate subjectively, okay? So I want to establish that differentiation, okay, between images of the night and heliopolitical images. I want to establish that differentiation between demetaphorized images and heliopolitical images, heliopolitical metaphors. Because the metaphor is always involved with God, okay? Any metaphor is always involved with God. The metaphor, or with metaphysics, if you want, okay? The metaphor establishes a difference between the literal and the figural is always transcendent. I want to think immanence, not transcendence.
Yeah, I mean, I was wondering if you could speak to what dialectics are and how they relate to infrapolitics and what you meant when you said that politics is always there.
Okay, great, thank you. Great question, okay. Of course, dialectics is associated with Hegel, okay? Hegel as the last thinker of metaphysics, or one of the last thinkers of metaphysics in the major epochal sense, okay? The thinker that established and closed the image of thought, okay, in the Western world, okay, through the notion of the absolute spirit, for instance, okay, or the notion that the subject is substance and substance is the subject, okay, thorough subjectivization of the universe connected with a thorough universalization of the subject, okay, that is dialectics, precisely. That final moment of the world of the absolute spirit. And the last line in the Phenomenology of Spirit is a mysterious line about the foam of the infinite that comes as a result of our having accomplished that identification, okay? We become infinite, we become immortal, okay? Once we have come into possession of the absolute spirit, okay? This is the moment of absolute accomplishment of world history as such, and the moment of the end of history, okay? Of course, Marxism is connected to dialectical thought in a very obvious way because it makes it explicit, okay? But I think that what we need to remember is that Marxism is not the only contemporary example of dialectical thought. Liberalism is also dialectical thought, okay? Because liberalism is also a radical thought of the subject, a radical thought of subjectivity and of the identification of subjectivity with the world spirit. Mm? That's what liberalism is about, okay? And by making a claim that infrapolitics is an attempt to counter-gaze dialectical thought, okay, I am obviously making a claim about, you know, leaving Hegel behind, okay, and setting thought on a different set of parameters. In other words, the claim is not mine, it's Heidegger's, okay? Dialectical thought is the main antagonist of our time, okay? Is the enemy. And remember, infrapolitics only has enemies.
What's the relationship between the leaderless politics or leaderless leadership and infrapolitics?
Yeah.
Is that a goal?
Yeah, another great question. Thank you so much. Okay, because I have said a couple of times, you know, in a very shorthand manner, that infrapolitics is not politics, and it isn't. Okay. But it is not anti-political, and infrapolitics still claims the right to criticize politics, okay? But criticize politics in the name of what, okay? Criticize politics for the sake of what, okay? So infrapolitics must develop a political dimension, okay? Infrapolitics must develop a political stance, okay? And we have tried to develop some thought along those lines, and we call it post-hegemonic democracy, okay? Leaderless democracy, anarcho-populism, marrano-populism. We have used a variety of names, okay?
If you think about marrano, that would be a good idea.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. But the point always is to undo hegemony, okay? In other words, to undo domination in the context of our lives, okay? Now, that domination must be undone at the existential level, and we call that infrapolitics, or second-order infrapolitics. But domination must also be undone at the political level, and we call that leaderless democracy, okay? Because the leader, as Weber makes it very clear, the leader is always after domination, okay? So, how can we develop political thinking that moves outside domination? You may say, well, this is idealistic, this is unreal, this is transcendent, but what we're claiming is the very opposite, okay? That it is the leader who is the embodiment of transcendence, of the ideal, of the sun, and so forth, okay? And therefore hegemony, okay? I mean, this is, obviously this gets us into hot water every time, okay? Because what we are doing is we are attacking the very image of leftist political thinking today, which is the notion of hegemony, okay, in Antonio Gramsci and Ernesto Laclau's sense. And we're saying, no, they're wrong, okay? It is not hegemony that we must look for, okay? Hegemony is a tool of domination, not a tool of liberation, every time, whether it happens in Bolivia or in Spain, okay?
Like a comment. I mean, listening to you, I was resonating with concepts such as emptiness and nothingness.
Emptiness and?
And nothingness.
Nothingness.
So it seems that you are speaking against a metaphysics of being, like a metaphysics of presence, from the point of view of emptiness, which is, for example, the wind, or it's not there, but it's there. But
yeah.
The tricky thing is to express emptiness and nothingness within the framework of being, of a metaphysics of being, for example. For instance, thinking with Heidegger. So this contradiction within that.
Yeah. Okay, again, another great question. Thank you so much. Okay. Because what you're calling emptiness and nothingness, and I see why you could bring those terms up, you know. That's what we call, or what I call, this is a collective project, you know, and I am thinking about this stuff with my friends. Sometimes I go to a we, but it's probably legitimate, okay? I should not appeal to the we, because then they say, what the hell are you talking about, we, you know? Speak for yourself, okay? So let me speak for myself, okay? What you call emptiness and nothingness and metaphysics of being, I am trying to thematize around the notion of the ontic-ontological difference in Heidegger, indeed, okay? In other words, it is not nothingness that is the invisible in Wilde's painting, okay? It is not nothingness that makes that curtain move, okay? And the angel is not moving towards nothingness, okay? And the fact that we cannot name it doesn't mean that the space of the name is empty, okay? It is simply the fact that our vocabulary, our language has been colonized by the metaphysics of presence, okay? And we have no words, you know, to talk about this beyond of facticity, within facticity, and so forth, you know? There was an example. This came to mind as I was thinking about Tarek's question, okay? I was on the plane from Newark to Houston, and I was sitting next to a woman with three kids, okay? One little kid next to her, and two slightly older girls in front. And I spent 4 hours completely mesmerized by the way this woman cared for her children, okay? Usually through her hands, because it was the only thing I could see. I could only see her hands, and she was just next to me. So I could only see her hands. Caressing the girl's hair, trying to find a game for the kid in the television, in the small television on the plane and all that. And, you know, I was thinking, well, this is infrapolitical existence going on, you know, right here, you know. This woman was not doing what she was doing out of a mere commitment to labor, okay? Although she was mothering, obviously, okay? But then I thought, you know, there is something in labor beyond labor, okay? And that something in labor beyond labor, the movement of her hands. This is not something Hannah Arendt ever explained, okay? In her famous book on the human condition, okay? She said, what is in labor beyond labor is politics. I said, no. This woman has nothing to do with politics right now. Okay? It is infrapolitics, okay? So, do I mean to say that the ontological difference came up as I was watching that woman's hands? Yes, I think so. The difference between being and beings came up right there. It is very difficult for us to make the associations, you know, to metonymize that movement in language, okay? Because our thought has been long colonized by a thought of politics, which is dialectical in origin, okay?
I was wondering if you could speak more about this image that's up here, the last quiz on the Kijimin, because you said something about it's not actually about the woman within it, that she's not in some way the subject of the, can you explain more? Because to me, the lighting is on her face and the way that it's, I'm drawn to her face in a particular way. Can you tell me how it's not about her?
Well, let's say the naive, vulgar way, I mean, this is something that Zizek might say, okay? I love Slavoj, but, you know, would be immediately the predatory way of, you know, look, isn't she hot, the maid, okay? That would be the subjectivist appropriation of the painting, the fetishistic sexual relationship to the painting, okay? The painting is all about the woman, okay? And it expresses a certain set of sexual fascination of I don't know, white Spanish males with African slaves serving in the kitchen and so forth, okay? A very obvious, trivial way of looking at the painting, and at many other paintings of the kind, and at many pornographic images that, you know, are available everywhere. But I think that the painting is precisely not about that, and it has nothing to do with that, okay? And why do I think that? I don't know. It is perhaps the glimmer of the objects, okay? Which I, of course, associate also with the ontic-ontological difference, okay? This painting, even in the way it depicts the woman, okay, is not a culturalist painting, okay? It doesn't represent culture in any way or manner. It is not a sexual painting. It doesn't represent love or sex in any way or manner. He doesn't attempt to portray the condition of slaves in 17th century Spain, it seems to me. It is not about race or gender, okay? It is about something else. What is that something else? We cannot name it, sorry. Okay? We cannot name it. But it is not nothing, okay? And it is not empty, okay? Where do we see that? Where can we detect that? Well, and of course that becomes a matter of infrapolitical thought, you know? What is that jug supposed to receive, and what is the jug about? What is that thing about? Okay. What about the color of the pot there? What does it tell you? You know. How can you name it? Do we have words for it? Do we have academic words for it? What would a cultural studies fellow do with this painting? We know what they would do, right? We know what they would do. I think that's insufficient.
And I think on this insufficiency, we should stop for today. And really, thank you very much.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. All right.
So we'll get
Christa?
Because we didn't have the time to
play anymore.
The presentation, because you could not have stopped.
Yeah.
And my questions were already in your chat. I stepped back.
No, thank you for doing that.
Yeah, and I think the recording is
good. The questions were very good.
See, there are some questions.